Infantile spasms need to be urgently dealt with. Both the spasms themselves, since the spasms are often occurring multiple times in a day, and that hypsarrhythmia pattern on the EEG, both of those things can be harmful to the brain. The quicker or the sooner that we treat this, the better the outcomes.
Dr. Penn, you are a pediatric epileptologist, which means you are a neurologist that strictly looks at pediatric patients who have seizures and epilepsy. I wanted to bring you here today because I wanted to talk about infantile spasms. And I want to talk about, you know, how to distinguish them from epileptic events or, you know, abnormal brain firings to, you know, maybe it's a gas issue, and how to determine that. So these are the, and then I want to talk about what's the, how to diagnose and then what the treatment is, okay? So first, let's talk about what infantile spasms are epileptically, if that's a word. I'm making it up right now. Or if it's not caused by the brain.
So epileptic spasms or infantile spasms, they are a type of seizure. They're specific to an age group. So we see infantile spasms in infants around like 3 to 12 months of age on average. And they can look very distinctive. So the way infantile spasms look clinically is typically like a major flexion of the body. So the head will flex downwards, the arms can flex upwards, kind of like a crunch inward. Those are flexor spasms. You can also have extensor spasms where the body moves the opposite direction or extends outward. But many times they could even look more subtle than that, like a subtle little head movement, eyes going up very subtly, things like that.
Yeah, and what, and sorry to interrupt, but what are kind of the distinctive features of something like that versus something that's not epileptic?
Sometimes it could be so hard to distinguish the two. I see what you're saying. And sometimes it can be so hard to distinguish spasms from reflux, gas, a startle response that most children have, or just normal baby behaviors that happens a lot. And many times we need to actually do additional testing to help tease out the difference between them. Reflux, for example, can cause irritation in the throat in infants and cause those similar types of positioning. So it can cause babies to kind of posture and move backwards or even flex and jerk forward. So they can almost look identical. And many times, not only the history we need to use, but we need to get an EEG test to distinguish between those two diagnoses.
And when you are looking at the history, what in particular are you looking for? Are you looking for a family history? Or are you looking for like a day, like a trigger or something like that?
So many times with spasms, there are no epilepsy risk factors. So many times we won't hear about a strong family history or things like that. Sometimes we do hear about a history of developmental delays, whether that be like a plateau or a stagnation of development or regression where a child is losing skills they used to have. So sometimes we do hear about those. But the other factors that we hear about, the other descriptors we hear about with spasms are these jerk-like movements of the body that are often clustered many times around time of waking up. So when a child wakes up from sleep or a nap, they can occur in clusters. Most times afterwards, the patient or the child can be very upset. So those are a few kind of like key terms that I keep in my mind that would gear me towards thinking this could be infantile spasms versus a different diagnosis.
It sounds like you're saying when they're tired or when they wake up, you're seeing more of these?
Typically, especially when kids wake up, that's when you tend to see these clusters of spasms.
And why is that? Is there something that's triggering the brain to do that?
So the underlying cause of infantile spasm, there's actually many different potential underlying cause of infantile spasms. There's not one thing that triggers it. Sometimes there can be something physical or structural in the brain that's wrong, causing the spasms. Sometimes it can be something genetic or a metabolic disorder causing the infantile spasms. with all of these patients, we pursue a pretty broad workup to look for all of these different answers. So that way we can understand the diagnosis and treat it appropriately.
Mm-hmm. Now, are infantile spasms, is it something you commonly see?
It is something that we do see from time to time. It's not the most common type of pediatric epilepsy. I don't exactly know how common it is, to be honest, but we do see it a good handful of times throughout the year within pediatric epilepsy.
And when do you see parents actually coming and bringing their children in? Like, is there something that they've noticed, or is it usually caught by, you know, is it caught by the parent usually?
It is often something that the parent will start to notice, that they're, you know, their baby is starting to have some new funny movements that they don't understand why it's happening. Many times they'll first seek out care with the pediatrician, but I do, I have seen a few patients with spasms who actually bring their children into the emergency department for a more rapid evaluation mm-hmm. because they realize their child's doing something very different that they never used to do.
Yeah, super scary, I imagine, to be in that situation. What are some things that the parent can do that can help you figure out what's really going on with their child?
That's a really great question. So having the parent have a good understanding of what these look like and when they occur can mm-hmm. be very helpful. So a description of what they look like or a video of what they look like can be helpful, especially since these occur in clusters. If the child starts having one, if the parent can take out their phone and capture a video of the cluster, that could be really useful for me. In addition, kind of when they happen, if the parent's able to either think about or write down when throughout the day they're noticing these, if there's any triggers for them. For example, if we're trying to distinguish between spasms and like reflux or something in the stomach bothering the child, are these always happening after feeds, or are these more sporadic and random throughout the day? So finding those types of patterns and provoking factors can be really helpful.
Yeah, that's huge. I'm sure that's mm-hmm. a lot. I'm sure that's great information for you to kind of consider when you're seeing their children. Mm-hmm. Let's say that you have a strong suspicion that these might be caused by mm-hmm. the brain. What is the next step there?
So the important next step is getting an urgent EEG, electroencephalogram. So the EEG during infantile spasms will look like a very distinctive pattern that's very well known to pediatric neurologists. This is a pattern called Hipps arrhythmia. And this, all the squiggly lines that you'll see on the EEG look very, very different from children who are not having infantile spasms. Mm. So between the actual seizures, the EEG background is very chaotic. All of the waveforms are very tall or high amplitude, high voltage, and very disorganized. So you don't see the normal rhythms that you typically would see.
Yeah.
And then interspersed within that chaotic, disorganized, slow background, you have all of these abnormal discharges, what we call spikes. And they're multifocal. There are multiple locations in the brain on the right and the left occurring asynchronously and randomly. And this pattern, again, is called Hipps arrhythmia. It's the hallmark pattern for patients with infantile spasms. Mm. And what I find most interesting about this pattern is that's not actually the seizure pattern. So seizures on EEG with Hipps arrhythmia look completely different. Mm. So during the actual infantile spasms, during the seizures, the EEG becomes very flat and you get this like very flat, low voltage, fast activity. And that's what you see during the actual seizures themselves. Mm. But this is a hallmark pattern that any pediatric neurologist would be able to identify and be able to nail down that diagnosis.
And so that's a strong indicator, this Hipps arrhythmia, this EEG pattern, which by the way is for parents who might be unfamiliar, is when you put little stickers on the head and monitor their brain waves. And this brain pattern creates this high voltage in Hipps arrhythmia is what you're saying. Mm-hmm. And it's so distinctive from normal that it is a strong indicator, right, for any neurologist to see that.
Exactly. And it is important to know that there are times where the spasms or the clinical abnormal movements can come first and precede the EEG changes. So sometimes if somebody gets an EEG, when there's concern for spasms, the EEG might be normal. But if you have really high suspicion for spasms, you actually repeat that EEG in a few weeks to make sure you're not missing that pattern on the EEG.
How long is the hips arrhythmia pattern on the EEG? Is it the baseline? Because I think you just said that you can see a normal EEG. And then, so yeah, how long is that hips arrhythmia pattern?
So sometimes you see it continuously, 24 hours a day. At other times you see it more often in sleep than in wakefulness. So what I always recommend, if there's any suspicion for spasms and the short or the initial EEG is normal, we keep the child on the EEG overnight through the morning or something like that to make sure we don't miss that pattern.
Okay.
Because sometimes it can wax and wane a little bit, and it's certainly not something that you want to miss.
Yeah. Let's say there's a scenario where you have confirmed that the infantile spasms, they have, that it is epileptic. I just want to be real upfront with the people, with the parents who might be listening. Is this a concerning EEG pattern? Is this a concerning event that's happening to the infant?
So it is. So this infantile spasms are, need to be urgently dealt with. The both the spasms themselves, since the spasms are often occurring multiple times in a day, and that hips arrhythmia pattern on the EEG, both of those things can be harmful to the brain, can impede development. And the quicker or the sooner that we treat this, the better the outcomes.
Okay.
So it certainly is an urgency, and any patient who is having concerns for spasms should be seen in the emergency department and seek immediate care, usually within days, I would say.
Yeah. Now, is there a particular syndrome that this is turning into or called, and what does that look like?
So there's a syndrome called West syndrome. We think of this as a triad. So there's the finding of hips arrhythmia on the EEG, the spasms, so the clinical infantile spasms that parents are seeing, and the developmental concerns. So whether that be delays in the development, or that the development kind of plateaus or stagnates, or if there's regression in the development and kids stop doing or stop achieving those milestones that they had previously attained. So this triad is called West syndrome. And we, again, take this as a medical urgency because we know that with West syndrome, the sooner you diagnose it, then the sooner you can initiate treatment, the better effects on development you will see. Less time seizures will persist throughout life. And it's much more common to have seizure freedom if we can treat this urgently.
Yeah. And when you say treatment, what is the treatment for a child with West syndrome?
So first line treatment is with medications. Steroid actually is the class of medications that we use. Some hospital systems use oral prednisolone, which is like a liquid solution. Some use ACTH, which is adrenocorticotropic hormone. Both seem to work well for spasms. And that's typically our first line treatment, to start that within hopefully days of the diagnosis. There are some specific syndromes, specifically tuberous sclerosis, which is a diagnosis a pediatric neurologist would make, which has this different first line treatment called vigabatrin. And that's just for specific circumstances. If the spasms are continuing, or if the hips arrhythmia pattern persists, sometimes we'll do combinations of different medications or switch to second and third line different types of treatments.
Okay. So with these treatments now, does that stop the infantile spasms? Does it stop the hips arrhythmia on the EEG?
So that's the goal. The goal is to stop the hips arrhythmia pattern and to stop the seizures from occurring. And that's, of course, what we aspire to reach to. Many times, the children who seem to do best and whose seizures tend to improve or stop are the ones who we don't find a cause of it for. What that means is we classify these patients as idiopathic infantile spasms. And what that means is there's nothing structural on the MRI We don't have an obvious metabolic disorder or genetic disorder causing it. But what's interesting is that group of patients tend to do the best and tend to respond the best to medications and other treatments. Versus if there is something abnormal on the imaging or something else, patients might not respond as well to medications. So to answer your question about, you know, how patients will do on the medications, it actually very much depends on the cause of the spasms and more like personal factors about those patients.
Yeah. So it varies.
It varies. Yeah.
Okay. And is this something that they have to take their whole life, or do you wean them off at a certain point?
Yeah. So the initial treatments are typically not lifelong.
Okay.
We'll continue it for usually a few months while the seizures go away, while the EEG pattern goes away, and then we'll wean off of the medication. Unfortunately, there's a subset of the patients with infantile spasms who do go on to have more repetitive seizures in life, and those patients would require different medications more throughout childhood, potentially lifelong.
Okay. So from what I hear you say is that, listen, and I understand because I'm a parent too, but if you're listening and you just notice that your child is having these spasms, don't jump to conclusions. This is all very scary what we're talking about probably, but you're not there yet. So having said that, what would be some advice that you would give to a parent who is really just kind of maybe freaking out right now and their infant is experiencing these episodes?
Got you. And it's a really scary place to be in. And again, this whole conversation has been really heavy because this is a serious topic. I mean, one of the more serious things that I deal with in my profession. So the fact that as a parent, you're seeing these, it means that you should seek immediate care. Mm-hmm. Because again, the most important part, if there's one take home message from this, is the faster we can diagnose it, the faster we can initiate treatment, the better the children do. Mm-hmm. So while this is very scary, kind of channel that into seeking out medical care for your child so that way we can do work from our end and begin the process of diagnosis and treatment if necessary.
Yeah.
But all of that being said, there are many mimickers for infantile spasms. So I agree that while I'm somebody who also gets ahead of myself and jumps to conclusions, it's really important to try not to. Try to gather that evidence to make the diagnostic process easier for the pediatrician and for the neurologist. But other than that, try to stay calm, try to gather that information and seek out care.
Yeah, great advice. And the last question that I have before I let you go, do you have to be an epileptologist to treat this or to manage this with a patient or a neurologist? Who's the one that can actually take care of these patients?
So a pediatric neurologist certainly has all the training and knowledge to be able to diagnose this and treat this as well.
Okay.
If the spasms become very difficult to treat and additional knowledge is needed, they can always consult with a pediatric epileptologist. But certainly starting off, the more important thing is getting into care quickly.
Yeah.
And neurologists should certainly be equipped to handle treatment of spasms.
Okay, very good. Well, thank you so much. That's great advice. I can't even imagine going through this as a parent, and the more information that they have, the more information we can put out there, I think the best. And so thank you for that, for giving your expertise. For everyone who's listening, like Dr. Penn said, please consult your physician, and the best of luck to you. So thank you very much, Dr. Penn.
Thank you for having me. Thank you for listening.